Hello and welcome to another gripping episode of Saved by the 90s. My name's Adam Patterson, and with me today is a guy who never goes for a plea bargain, Ken Bakley. Hey, Ken.
Hello.
This month, we're heading to court with reviews of four legal thrillers released throughout the decade, so skip that jury duty summons because this is Saved by the 90s.
Why is Coors Light the official beer of the 90s? Let's count the reasons. One, the silver bullet is the beer that won't slow you down. Two, it's brewed with pure Rocky Mountain spring water. Three, it's got a neat silver can. Four and five, Coors Light is available in all 49 states and Canada. And six, it tastes good. Let's keep all six reasons in mind the next time you want a beer. Thank you.
Okay, so obviously there's a lot to unpack there, but if I have to choose one, I think the first thing that caught me was the official beer of the 90s.
Yeah.
Does it change every decade?
I don't know. Maybe there's a maybe a beer gets crowned as an official beer.
But and so yeah, they get special status. But if it's like the Olympics, where they have to choose it like 7 years early, it was the beer of the 90s crowned in 1983.
If that was the case, it would probably be I don't know if that's... never mind. I was going to say wine coolers, but that's really not beer.
Okay, so we're just going to leave the rest of that. Let that as it is, and we'll move on. And offer our salutes both to the late Leslie Nielsen and to the official beer of the 90s. First up on the docket is Aaron Sorkin's first foray into film with an adaptation of his popular 1989 play. Directed by Rob Reiner and released on December 11th, 1992, this is A Few Good Men.
You want to investigate me, roll the dice and take your chances. A rookie lawyer.
Do you think Santiago was murdered?
It doesn't matter what I believe. It only matters what I can prove.
A feared colonel. Don't ever question my orders. In a battle for truth.
I want to slam dunk this guy.
Tom Cruise, Jack Nicholson, Demi Moore in a Rob Reiner film.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
A Few Good Men, rated R. At theaters December 11th.
Military lawyer Lieutenant Daniel Caffey defends Marines accused of murder. They contend they were acting under orders. Ken, we'll start it with you. What were your initial impressions of A Few Good Men?
I mean, obviously, this is one of those movies that's just seeped so deeply into the culture that I thought that I might have seen it before, but it turns out I had not. This was a first-time watch for me, and I thought I might have seen it just based on its ubiquity. There's obviously, you know, the very famous "you can't handle the truth" moment, but there's it is really just one of those movies that's kind of just found its way perhaps through basic cable ubiquity into the culture. Actually, the way that I'll point that out is the currently, as of the time we're recording this, the only way to watch this movie in the United States through a rental service would be to buy it. Like it was like $14 or something, and I wasn't doing that. But I found that the workaround was on Amazon Prime, you could sign up for a free trial, a 7-day trial of AMC Plus, which I think gave you, like, let you stream some of the things that had aired on AMC, and it also let you view a live stream of the AMC network feed. And at the exact moment I signed up for it to watch A Few Good Men, A Few Good Men was airing on AMC on the East Coast at that exact time.
I'm actually with you on that. I'm pretty sure this is a first time for watch for me too. I know that I've seen bits and pieces of it throughout the years, probably on TV, but I'm pretty sure that I never sat down to watch the, like, unedited version of this from beginning to end. In fact, I'm pretty sure I haven't seen any of the movies we're going to be talking about this month. Like, I probably did, but I really don't remember any of them at all. So this was an interesting month for me.
I've seen a couple of these. In fact, I've seen a couple of them quite recently. Which is kind of how I got the idea, but we'll get more to that in a minute. But as for A Few Good Men, I don't have a terribly high amount to say about it. I think it's a perfectly fine movie. I think it's a very, like, solidly made courtroom drama that maybe the more it goes on gets a little bit tiring, which is kind of... that is very Aaron Sorkin, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Sorkin is in full effect. here. I thought maybe it would be a little bit different because it was, you know, one of his early screenplays. So I thought maybe it was going to be a little different, but nah, it's 100% Sorkin all the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like to the point of like the Sorkin self-parody that could set in a little bit later when nobody was going to like hold him back anymore. But yeah, you definitely feel it. I mean, kind of out of curiosity, I also watched this week, we're not going to talk about it proper, but I also watched the next Rob Reiner, Aaron Sorkin collaboration, which was The American President, which I think is kind of famous now for sort of being the unofficial, like, spiritual prequel to The West Wing. It has, like, a bunch of people that were going to be on The West Wing in it, and it has that kind of same energy. Mm-hmm. And that's weirdly one where I think, there were times when I wish there was less of it, but for the problems, and probably very fair problems a lot of people have with The West Wing, I think The American President as a two-hour movie kind of is able to concentrate it together in a way that feels more digestible. And it's got a really, really good, just a great, unapologetically, just carefully over-the-top Mark Scheiman score, as does this movie as well.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I like Aaron Sorkin for the most part. I think that all of his scripts tend to be overwritten, but sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes it's a good thing. Sometimes his dialogue is just completely on point. Like, you're just like, damn, Sorkin, bringing the heat. But I think that happened more than like where you're just like eye rolling in this movie. I think that there were some really great bits of dialogue, really great interactions. I mean, especially with, you know, Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson. The funny thing is, like, you have, like, the two of them going head-to-head is, like, the big moment. That's, like, the big denouement of this movie. And it doesn't really happen until the very, very end, at the end of the trial. And it's just, like, one scene. So, in fact, Jack Nicholson's not even in this that much.
He is very memorable.
I thought that he was going to be in it a lot more, but he's really only in it for like maybe three or four scenes. He just, for the most part, he's not present in it. Now, of course, you have Tom Cruise and Demi Moore as the two leads here. I think that they both do a fine job. I think Cruise is, I mean, come on, he always does an incredible job.
We are going to have so much discussion about Cruise this month.
Yeah, I think he's really good in this. I think that his style works well with a Sorkin script. Just the fast dialogue mixed with some light humor in there, and I think that he really works well within this type of script, and I think that he did a great job. As did everybody else. I mean, there's a lot of people in this. You got Kevin Bacon, Kiefer Sutherland, Kevin Pollak, Christopher Guest in here, which I thought was an interesting little, I don't know if you want to call it a cameo. Cuba Gooding Jr. in an early role for him. Noah Wiley. So lots of really good people in here. And yeah, as far as like courtroom dramas go, I think that this is it's pretty top tier. It's compelling. I liked the conspiracy aspect of it. I think Rob Reiner's a great director, and I think that he did a great job with directing this. I thought visually it was pretty standard, but there were some flourishes in there that I thought added a little bit of artistic flair to it.
It's actually always something kind of like telling about how any given courtroom film will choose to frame the courtroom, which we'll talk more about that. I think there's a certain contrast to be drawn with another movie we're going to be talking about later, but this one is very much like bright room filled with like importance and the understated belief that this all has to work out.
Oh yeah,
fits, I guess, to whatever extent that the end of the movie can fit it, but we'll talk more about that later, but I think it's important to always look at a courtroom drama and think about how the courtroom is being framed. Or if not important, interesting. But yeah, I agree with you. This is a solidly made movie. I do have my own reservations with it, which are maybe just kind of my own, like, weird, imprecise feelings about Sorkin. Like, I feel like he's, for me, like, just one of those writers that I can simultaneously admire, like, his craft at being Aaron Sorkin, and also resent it for the same reasons that I'm admiring what he's doing. Yeah, I think with a good, capable director, the material can really work. When there isn't a capable director to kind of grapple with material, it doesn't work quite as well as we saw last year in The Trial of Chicago 7, which was written and directed by Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, I couldn't help but think about that movie while I was watching this and just thinking about how much more competent this is as a courtroom drama.
Nobody claps at the end of A Few Good Men.
That is true.
Not gonna start clapping.
That is true. I don't think I rolled my eyes once during this movie. Trial of Chicago 7, I rolled my eyes multiple times over some of the ridiculous lines.
There are times when the movie's just one continuous eye roll.
Yeah. I gave myself a migraine. My eyes were rolling so much during that movie.
Yeah. It's bonkers. But yeah. Yeah, this is solid. I think it's one of those movies that I understand why it plays. It's probably gotten so much life on TV because it is one of the movies that just really plays well on TV, because in the sense that it's a movie that you just kind of like stay with. It'll just kind of grab you while you're channel surfing, and it's just solid enough that it'll keep you there.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's similar to My Cousin Vinny. Like, My Cousin Vinny has the same kind of hooks that it will get in you, and I think that's why they play My Cousin Vinny all the time on TV, because it does a similar thing. My Cousin Vinny. Oh, we will talk about My Cousin
Vinny. It's such a great movie.
This was nominated for many awards, including Academy Award nominations for Best Picture, Best Actor in a Supporting Role, Jack Nicholson, Best Sound, and Best Film Editing. Best Sound is interesting, because I don't really know if I noticed any particularly outstanding sound in it, other than like that opening sequence with the rifles.
And it's a sequence.
Yeah, it's a cool opening.
Yeah. It's pretty good. I would also happen to know that the movie was not nominated for Best Director, and the reason I know that is because when I was younger, and by young, I mean like a few years ago, not really a long, long time ago, but I would like go through and watch a bunch of like old like Oscar ceremonies and all the clips they would upload. And I mean, we can debate about the legacy of Billy Crystal as an Oscar host, but one of the more, I think, kind of benign, unremarked upon things that he would do is he would always like make it a big deal, you know, because he was hosting in an era of 5 Best Picture nominees and 5 Best Director nominees, of when there was like it didn't match up, which was I think more often than not. And I remember looking back at that ceremony, made a whole big deal about how they couldn't come up with another nomination for A Few Good Men for Rob Reiner in director, so he was the odd director out that year. I don't know what made me think of that. I think it's just because you mentioned the Oscar. Now I have to find out. The lone director that year was Robert Altman for The Player, which is a very good movie.
Yeah, that's a good movie. I mean, I don't know if Reiner deserved an Oscar for this movie, really, because
I'm not about to say that he did.
Yeah, I mean, like it is an adaptation of a play. Let's be real. Like they could have pretty much just had this whole thing be in a courtroom for the most part, and it would have still worked as is. So I feel like while Reiner does a really good job with the directing, I don't think that it was anything like remarkable.
It's understandable, and I'm doing the thing that I hate the most now in talking about this through the lens of awards, but it's understandable why he would not be like thought of as someone you nominate for Best Director, because it is good direction, but it is not remarkable direction that feels like it's this, you know, it's the holding it together, even though he is a director and he's directing, and that's kind of what
and I think that Yeah, and I think that also the director can easily be credited with the performances and the success of the performances, and certainly this has some really strong... I mean, Nicholson got nominated for his performance, and so I think that that can be attributed to it as well.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a lot of moving parts to that, and at any rate, I think that Rob Reiner is an Oscar-worthy director. I just don't necessarily think that maybe for this movie.
Yeah. And I think there's also an element that my perception has always been, as long as Aaron Sorkin has been a, you know, writer, moving from plays where such a distinction make more sense, but into film and TV, there, he's always, to me, I've perceived, had that idea of the writer as a star.
Yeah.
Like the one of the writers that gets the household name designation. You think of this as more Aaron Sorkin's movie than you do think of it as Rob Reiner's movie, if we're thinking about
absolutely. Yeah. I think it's understandable. I think a lot of people probably forget that Rob Reiner even directed this movie, honestly.
I mean, if we're going to talk about, again, movies where you forget who directed it and then you're surprised, we have one coming up later in the show.
Yeah, we do. We definitely do. All right. Well, before we move on, is there anything else you wanted to touch on with A Few Good Men? Definitely check it out. I think that we can both recommend it.
Yeah. I mean, like I said earlier, and as you can kind of tell by the sheer number of like sidetracks I've taken us on, I just don't have a terrible amount to say. I think it's just a really solidly accomplished movie with a very good cast and very good directing and a very good script. And there are times when it becomes a bit unwieldy, but it really works.
I think it's also a good representation of how women were perceived in both the military service and in like legal services during this time too. That's something that gets touched on a bit. You have Demi Moore's character who is, she works for internal affairs, right? It's her designation, but I think that she's always, you know, struggling with her position because of her gender. And I think that that's something that we can touch on again in a movie that's coming up. And I think that these movies, I think, are interesting because they're not that old, but I feel like even in that amount of time that a lot of progress has been made.
I think there's definitely, in
regards to equality in the workplace.
Yeah. I think there's definitely the space for commentary on that in this movie, and the movie does make some overtures to it, but again, I don't know if Aaron Sorkin's always been the one that really was able to do that in the most tactful of ways, so.
Yeah, it's not really explored too much. Next up, we have another Tom Cruise courtroom drama. This one is based on a John Grisham novel, a name you'll hear a few more times this episode, released on June 30th, 1993, and directed by Sidney Pollack. This is The Firm.
We ought to keep him on a pretty tight leash. You've got nothing to be suspicious about.
I get paid to be suspicious when I got nothing to be suspicious about.
Tom Cruise.
If those guys at the steak joint were feds, you better watch out for them.
In the motion picture suspense thriller of the year.
Your life as you know it is over.
If we run, they find us.
Based on the number one bestseller.
Nobody has ever left us. Nobody.
The Firm. Rated R. Starts Wednesday, June 30th, everywhere.
A young lawyer joins a prestigious law firm, only to discover that it has the sinister dark side. So, this is actually the primary inspiration behind this lineup, because a few weeks ago I discovered, much to my absolute astonishment, that The Firm was released in June 1993, which does not make any sense. Like, you can't even imagine that. I mean, I'm sure anyone who's talked about this movie in recent years and brings the release date will say that, but if you think about movies like, and the seasonal releases of movies along the lines of, like, what does it feel like? What's the what's like kind of the energy if you're living in a temperate, you know, northern hemisphere climate. You know, you do not really think of this as like the movie where you go to see it and then 2 hours and 45 minutes later you leave and it's like, well, time to go to the neighbor's 4th of July barbecue.
Yeah. Let's bust out the slip and slide, cook some hamburgers and hot dogs after we go to the theater and sit through The Firm.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, Adam, what do you think of The Firm?
I had a lot of fun with this. Again, this is one that I thought that I saw before, but I am like 99.5% sure that I did not see this movie because it was all completely new to me. So I really enjoyed The Firm. I think that several of the movies that we're going to be discussing this month are way too long. Like, they definitely could have been trimmed down. We'll get to some of the length nitpicks I have with some of the other ones, but this one, I don't feel like the length was as problematic as some of the other ones.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it, for the most part. I thought, again, Tom Cruise was, he did a pretty good job in here. I mean, his character in this was pretty much the same as in, Few Good Men. Basically the same character. And you know, you have Gene Hackman in here, who is great. I love Gene Hackman in everything that he's in. So
let's please talk about this incredible supporting cast here.
I know. You have Hal Holbrook in here. Mm. You have Jean Triplehorn. Now, to be clear, I'm not a big fan of Jean Triplehorn, but she does a really good job in this. You have Wilfred Brimley in here. There's a really great scene when Tom Cruise beats the crap out of Wilfred Brimley with an attaché case. So that's that's something that you, I mean, really, that's the price of admission right there, just to see Cruise beating Wilfred Brimley over the head with a briefcase. David Strathairn. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, but to be clear, that happens at about a minute 145 of 154, and I think it is worth 145 minutes, even if you're just there for that.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
It's just a scene where, like, when you start watching The Firm, you know something bad is going to happen, but you don't know that how it's going to culminate there. And at the culmination of two excellent performances from Tom Cruise and Wilfred Brimley in this wonderfully indulgently long movie. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, you have Ed Harris in here as this FBI agent. You have Holly Hunter in an incredible role as the secretary of this private investigator. The private investigator played by Gary Effin Busey. You have David Strathairn in there. You have Jigsaw. Tobin Bell is in here as this...
It took me a minute to figure out who that was, and...
He's got this like long, like thin, long platinum hair. He's like albino in this, and yeah, he plays like a hitman. What a cast!
Hitman or something.
As far as the four movies that we're covering this month, I had the most fun with The Firm, especially in the first half. I think that the setup, everything. It almost had this like kind of Stepford Wives kind of vibe, where he gets in on this, like he gets hired as a new lawyer in this small firm in, I think it was Tennessee, right? It's in Memphis. And they give him like all this money. They give him a house, they give him a car, and he very quickly sees like, okay, these people are kind of weird. Like, there's something weird going on here. And then as he gets to know people and the clients and stuff, he realizes that this firm is actually working with the mob. But not only that, the Chicago Mafia, actually. But not only that, they're like skimming money off of all of their clients, and he uncovers this giant conspiracy, and it's great. I had a blast with The Firm.
Yeah, it's I don't think I liked it quite as much as you did, but not for any like particularly strong held reasons, because I do agree that it is, it, like, once it really gets into the rhythm of what it's doing, it is just a great time, you know, to watch this excellent, like, really big cast of supporting actors, and then there's, you know, Tom Cruise doing what he does, and doing it very well. I think tremendous enjoyment that the movie takes in uncovering each piece of information and just relishing it and relishing all the implications of it. Like, it's a movie, and we will finesse this point with the next two movies we're going to discuss, but it is a movie that is very long, with relatively little in terms of, like, out of nowhere plot developments or, you know, or purposefully intricate plot developments, and yet one that relishes living in the space that it's living in, and I think it does that to really great effect.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's a pretty large scale movie. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot of moving pieces. There's this whole, like, there's some, like, kind of like espionage type things that are happening here, where, like, Gene Triplehorn is, like, seduces Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman is such a sleaze in this. In fact, all the men in this movie basically are just horrible. They're horrible sleaze bags. And, like, Gene Hackman's character is, like, hitting on Gene Triplehorn's character, who plays Tom Cruise's wife, and he's just hitting on her the whole movie. And then finally, she needs to distract him basically, and she agrees to his advances, sort of, and ends up drugging him. That was a little bit disappointing, where you find out that they killed Gene Hackman's character, but it was just through, like, a brief conversation, like, oh yeah, like, yeah, he's dead, they found him dead. And I was like, oh, well, they it felt like they were building up Gene Hackman's character to be, like pretty major, but then they dismissed him so, like, nonchalantly. I felt like there should have been a little bit more with that. Like, I don't know if you necessarily have to show him getting killed or anything, but just something more, to add a little bit more weight to the fact that he got murdered. This was nominated for 2 Oscars. Holly Hunter got nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Totally deserving. I think she was fantastic in this.
Yeah, it is such a good performance.
She's so good. And
I just saw what the other nomination is.
Best Music for Dave Grusin, I guess you say, which is baffling to me, because I thought the music was horrible. I couldn't stand the music in this movie.
It is like this... This guy, it's not even like a low-key jazz. It's like a weird, like the first coup you hear, like, on its own, feels like, I don't know, like a Casio keyboard tier interpretation of, like blues piano.
It's like, so weird.
Okay, maybe that's a bit harsh, but, like, in the context of the movie, it does feel really jarring and, like, elementary. And I did listen to it, like, on its own later, and, like, I'm like, this is not a bad composition, actually. Like my initial reactions... First time I saw this movie not too long ago, and then when I rewatched it, it was like, this is just a completely terrible choice of this awful, awful music. I think, one, it stands out, which is not a good thing, but two, if you listen to it on its own, it's like, this is like a solid, this is an okay score, but only if you take it away from the movie it's in.
Yeah, but I think that part of the problem was that it never felt like it fit. Like, it was always, anytime... You would get that there would be a music cue and you would hear it. It, as you said, it's always noticeable and it never seems to fit within the context of the scene. And it gave the whole movie this, like, kind of noir vibe to it, where this movie felt much, much more like a noir than a legal thriller. And I think that is in large part due to the music. But I think that that's kind of doesn't really do it justice, because I think it works better as a legal thriller as opposed to some sort of noir. And yeah, I just could not get behind the music at all. It just, it was so weird, and I was like, this is really strange.
I mean, I was mean to the score, but on the other hand, from the last year when I first saw it to when I rewatched it for this, I never forgot that it was there.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's weird.
I do like it. Just the casual, insane line on the Wikipedia article. The film soundtrack is almost entirely solo piano by Dave Grusin.
It's definitely unique. It's not a score that that I think you'll forget. You'll definitely remember the firm for its strange musical choices. A lot of these movies that we're talking about this month deal with technology, glorious 90s tech. And this movie had a funny scene where they're basically trying to copy these court documents, and they're trying to do it really quickly because they can't get caught. And there's a scene where Tom Cruise is printing out these court documents, and he prints out two sets of documents. Each one of them says 72 pages. And it's a dot matrix printer that's printing this out. And I'm like, and of course, in the context of the movie, it prints out in like 5 minutes. But in actuality, to print, you know, 144 pages on a dot matrix printer would probably take hours.
Yeah, he would still be doing that today, 28 years later.
Yeah, and it would be so loud, too. That's the other thing. Like, he was trying to do everything covertly, and it would just be making that horrible dot matrix noise for like hours and hours. I could have used some more Busey. I was a little disappointed that Busey got killed so quickly, because this is like,
I mean,
pure crazy Busey. I kind of loved it.
Is it ever?
Kind of loved it. I kind of wish I got to see more. Like, I wanted to see Busey actually like in doing some investigations and stuff. I think that would have been fun.
Yeah. Busey just like becomes like a full-on supporting character who just saves the day at the end. What if it was Gary Busey who started beating people up with attaché cases?
Oh man, to see Busey beating up Brimley, oh my god,
this might become the most famous movie of all time.
Yeah, if it was Busey versus Brimley, and I think it definitely would. And if you put in like, or if you had like Busey beating the crap out of Hal Holbrook. Oh my god, that would have been great too.
Yeah. R.I.P. Hal Holbrook and Wilford Brimley.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's it's an interesting movie because, I mean, obviously not only on the merit of its release date being inherently interesting now, but just a movie that is so unafraid to be about just, until the end, just a bunch of people, mostly people just looking at documents for large portions of it.
Oh, yeah.
And printing them.
Yeah. Well, there's a decent amount of excitement later on in it,
though. Oh, yeah. And but also that is exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there is a lot going on to it, but you know, I just automatically inflate all every time there's a document or a computer in a movie. I automatically overinflate its performance because I think it's always very exciting when characters are just looking at documents.
Hey, Gary Becker, why should I make a claim? Too many people are already making claims.
Actually, personal injury cases account for less than 1% of all court filings. And every time we help a client recover for a loss, it also forces the negligent party to pay more attention to safety. If we're really going to change this country, we need to be sure people are held accountable for their behavior.
If you're the victim of an automobile accident, call the Becker Law Office.
Our third feature this month is also based on a John Grisham book, the second in what would become an onslaught of adaptations of his work throughout the decade. Directed by Alan J. Pakula and released on December 17th, 1993, this is The Pelican Brief.
In a single night, two Supreme Court justices will be brutally assassinated. A lone law student has pieced together who did the killings and why. Now she has become a target. From the best-selling thriller by the author of The Firm and The Client, Academy Award nominee Julia Roberts, Academy Award winner Denzel Washington, The Pelican Brief.
A law student uncovers a conspiracy, putting herself and others in danger. I think it was funny that there was, I don't remember what I was looking at where it had a different synopsis, and it said something like a female lawyer or something like that, a female law student. And I was just like, well, why is that necessary to mention that it's a female law student? I don't remember.
Apparently, a synopsis written in universe by some of the characters in this movie.
Yeah, I know. Ken, what did you think of The Pelican Brief?
This is a very long movie.
Oh my god, yeah. This one, I don't know. I think that our last movie felt the longest, and I'll get in. I'm sure that you agree with me as to why, but this one, yeah, I think as far as the length goes and how long they felt, this was definitely the second longest. This movie felt like an epic.
This movie is 13 minutes shorter than The Firm, but it doesn't do it. It isn't able to luxuriate in its length the way that The Firm is, because it is a movie that necessarily feels like quite rushed at times, like it's rushing to something, but it's not rushing to anything because it takes longer to get there than the movie itself seems to think. Like, it's a movie that feels like it's not communicating well with itself sometimes.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I thought that this movie was just okay. I didn't love it. This was another one that I thought I saw at some point, but I definitely didn't, because I remembered nothing about it. So it's I think that it's a compelling premise. I think that it starts off interesting. You have, as the synopsis says, two Supreme Court justices get assassinated, and then you have Julia Roberts, who plays this law student who, just for funsies, comes up with a brief. She writes a Pelican Brief, if you will, about her theory as to who's responsible, and it sort of goes up the chain, and basically everybody who gets into contact with the brief gets killed. So yeah, that's sort of how it goes.
Yeah.
You have Denzel Washington in here as a journalist, so the two of them sort of team up to try to put the pieces together and get the evidence that they need to confirm that this conspiracy is like a real thing. And then you have Sam Shepard in here as, you know, maybe I haven't seen all of Sam Shepard's movies, certainly, but I like the guy. And he is such a sleaze in this movie. I could not stand him. The way that he treated, so he's dating Julia Roberts. He's her professor, and they're dating. And just, he was so touchy-feely the whole time. It was just really icky.
Well, the thing about the character is you don't have to deal with him very long, because he is one of the people that comes into contact with the brief.
Yeah. I think he's like one of the first ones that gets killed by
the
brief.
He's one of the first ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gets his ass blown up in a car. Mm-hmm. I was happy. I was like, okay, good. Now I don't have to see him, like, rubbing Julia Roberts' hair and smelling her and touching her all the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Creepy.
Yeah.
And he was an alcoholic too, and he was like, just not good for her, you know?
Yeah.
I just wanted her to get out of that relationship.
Well, she did.
Yeah, she did. Very happy.
Yeah. It's a movie where I can reiterate all of my complaints about the length, and yet I still, or the way that the movie conducts itself, and yet at the same time, I don't dislike it. I didn't have like an actively bad time watching it. I think it is, again, it's just one of these kind of just really committed, like mid-budget drama slash thriller kind of movies that just gets about its business in a really just efficient, like, interrogative way. Like, it's like we have this director here, Alan J. Pakula, who of course, had a tremendous trilogy of, as they've been thought of, like a tremendous trilogy of movies in the 70s about, like, conspiracies and corruption with Clute and the Parallax View and All the President's Men. And that kind of has sort of set the tone for how you think about a lot of the major American dramas in the 70s. And I think at this later point in his career, you can still kind of see, like, it makes sense that that would be, it would be, this movie would be directed by the same person who made those movies.
Sure.
It's maybe not as, like, inherently, like, intensely immediate as those are, but at the same time, there is, like, this incredible sense of just, like, intuition over how the an audience would want this story told to them that maybe gets a little bit badly carried out in the script, which is weird because he also wrote the adaptation here of the Grisham novel. But as a director, I really don't have any complaints with the way that this movie is directed in a way, because it is just like that really solidly committed movie that is just so fully ensconced in the world of it. I'm just sort of in real time trying to finesse where are my problems with this movie coming from, because there's a lot about this movie that I admire, and there's a lot that I kind of had reservations about. And I think maybe it is at some level at the level of the adaptation here. I can't comment about the Grisham novel, but there's just something that's kind of getting lost in the space between the fairly compelling storyline and the fairly compelling execution of it.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think that it was fine. I actually don't have much to say about it. Was this the one? I neglected to write it down, and I watched all these movies pretty much back to back, and I can't remember which one it was, but there was one of them that the movie used, like, crash zooms like crazy. Like, just crash zooms everywhere. And I can't remember if it was this one or one of the other ones, but I wanted to write that down because one of these damn movies was using crash zooms like crazy, and I enjoyed it, but it was also like there were so many crazy zooms happening that it was like overt. Can't remember which one it was. It was either this one or maybe the firm.
I think it was the firm. Pause for a second. I'm trying to remember.
It probably was. There was a scene when somebody it might have been this one actually, because there was a scene where there was like somebody watching TV and they got shot. And the blood splattered onto the TV.
Yeah, this is this one. That's this one.
And they did that fast zoom right into the blood splatter on the TV. I think that was when they killed the really, really old justice.
That's a different scene later in the movie. But yeah, you're confusing that with another kind of similar approach, I think, early on the movie. So yeah, it's all fitting together now. Yeah, that's this one.
I kind of liked that.
Yeah. Almost becomes endearing.
Yeah, I think that there were some interesting choices when it comes to the cinematography in this one. I think that for the most part, the other movies that we talked about were fairly standard. I think that this one is the one that takes the most artistic risk. Not to say that it really does anything too crazy, but there were several scenes that I thought looked really good. Cast wise, you have a really solid cast in this one as well. In addition to the people that I already mentioned, you have John Hurd, the late John Hurd, in here. You have Stanley Tucci,
who plays great Stanley Tucci performance. He's not in it a lot, but when he is, it's great.
Yeah, he plays a hitman, and he's. He doesn't even really have that many lines in it, but yeah, he's
a presence.
Yeah, he is definitely a presence. John Lithgow's
in never here. Unwelcome.
John Lithgow's great. He plays like the editor of the paper. Cynthia Nixon, who looks extremely young in this. She looks like a teenager in this.
I almost didn't realize at first.
Yeah. Jake Weber for a little bit in there, but it's funny, like, you hear him on the phone before you see him, and as soon as I heard the voice, I was like, that's Jake Weber. Just knew it was him right away. So you have a pretty good cast in here as well. I enjoyed the story. I enjoyed the kind of conspiracy of it. It was fine. There were some fun little, like, cat and mouse sequences. in here are some chase sequences and stuff that I thought were pretty fun. It's nothing outstanding, though. It feels like your kind of standard Grisham thing. I do want to talk about Grisham in the 90s, though, and maybe we'll have to do, like, a second part to this where we talk more about Grisham in the 90s, because...
What a decade, man. This man had in the 1990s.
Holy cow, yeah. I mean, so it started with The Firm. Like, that was the first adaptation that came out. And then you had The Pelican Brief after that, The Client, which I loved The Client, by the way. Incredible. A Time to Kill. You had The Chamber, The Rainmaker, and then you had The Gingerbread Man. I definitely didn't see The Gingerbread Man. That was directed by Altman. I mean,
so, The Firm is his second novel. Like, the first, like, this first novel was A Time to Kill, which mm-hmm. was published in 89. The Firm is his second novel that just becomes a huge hit. And then his third novel is The Pelican Brief. And then his fourth novel is The Client.
Yeah, which is crazy because these are getting adapted, like... shortly after they're released, right? Because A Time to Kill, that was 89, but The Firm was 91. And then the mm-hmm. movie came out in 93. And then The Pelican Brief was, he wrote it in 92. And then the movie came out in 93. The Client was 93. And the movie came out in 94. I mean, man, he was just on a tear.
Yeah. I'm curious to know if there was any point where this started, because... from the limited amount that I'm reading while we're looking at this, it's that A Time to Kill is, you know, it's one of those classic stories about an author, like, their first novel is rejected by, in this case, apparently 28 publishers, and then a small publishing house gives it a 5,000 copy run. But then he does The Firm, which is his second novel, which was published by Doubleday and was the best-selling book of 1991, maybe? Apparently, the best-selling novel of 1991, 47 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, gets adapted into a very successful movie, and then he kind of enters into that period of, like, very successful and very prolific authors where the rights get purchased before the novel gets published.
Yeah, he's a very bankable author, I think, that I think they realize, like, you know, you go to any airport and you'll be able to sell his books very easily. Definitely one of those types of authors. And I mean, I never read any of his. I actually owned a copy of The Firm, but I never read it. I remember as a kid looking at it and just, it was so, I don't know how many pages it was. It was a huge book, and I just remember being so overwhelmed by it. I just never got into it. But yeah, he, man. What a run. And like, all of the movies are pretty good, too. I mean, at least all the ones that I've seen.
If you want another fun fact, I'm looking at a list of John Grisham novels right now. Between 1989 and 2001, all of his novel titles started with the article A or The, and the first one that didn't was Skipping Christmas, which was adapted to the 2004 film Christmas with the Cranks.
Yeah. I like on the Wikipedia how they have a little symbol by the ones that aren't legal thrillers. Like, these are the ones that are not in the legal genre. But mm-hmm. then you have including his children's legal thrillers, his Theodore Boone series.
Which I think I told you, I am pretty sure that I have read at least part of the first one when I was a kid. And the reason is that title and that cover look familiar to me. So I think it might have been one of those things, I don't know, maybe I got it at a Scholastic book fair or something, and I read, like, I don't know, 20 pages of it and then put it away, and it's who knows what box it's in now, but I think I might have read some of that, and I can't tell you a thing about it.
I just like that it's categorized as children's legal thrillers. I've been thinking about that since I first read it, like, a children's legal thriller.
Clearly popular, because there's seven of them. Because
when I think of children's legal thrillers, I think of, like, little children. Like, like elementary school kids.
8 to 13.
Obviously, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's meant for like older kids, but like, I just think of like really like babies, like baby legal thrillers.
I would love that. Baby's first legal thriller.
Oh, man.
It's the kind of career that I just really do admire. He found the lane that he was very successful in, and he found it relatively early on, and he's continued down that path with considerable success. I mean, pretty straightforward story.
Yeah, he started off as a lawyer, and then he ended up going into politics and was a member of the Mississippi House of Representatives for, what, 6 years?
6 years.
And then from there, that's when he got into writing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's definitely an interesting career. And, I mean, he's still cranking them out. I mean, he writes about a book a year.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still at it. He's 66 now, so
he's
still got plenty of time to...
Quite a few more years. He's, like prolific enough that where it's not like one of where he doesn't automatically look like one of those like really popular authors where it's like, oh no, you don't write them anymore. We're like the ones where they're writing like 5 books a year.
Yeah.
It's like you like though they are professional writers of outlines, but
yeah. Interestingly, Christmas with the Cranks was the last feature film adaptation. I'm wondering if surely there will be more. I think it's only a matter of time before they did go back to that well, but I think it's interesting that that was the last one, Christmas with the Cranks.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
I don't know if you saw, have you seen Let Them All Talk, the Steven Soderbergh movie?
No.
Yeah, well, there's a scene where Meryl Streep is playing this very, you know, acclaimed author of very serious literary fiction, and she's talking to this author who writes kind of like more airport novels kind of stuff, and so she is kind of struggling to write a book, and he is one of those people who has it so down to like a science that he's, you know, that his output is measured in more like the number of books he's writing per year. And like there's this really funny conversation where the Meryl Streep character is like barely masking her complete bewilderment that of that this person, I guess, is also an author of books. Where it's just this extremely like funny, all these extremely funny reactions. But yeah, I mean, this is such a great career.
Yeah, it most certainly is. All right, anything else to add about the Pelican Brief before we move on to another Grisham?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I don't know why we're trying to give our final words on like the career trajectory of Grisham, because we're about to talk about him more.
Yeah. And that wraps things up, and here's the next Grisham thing. Our final title this month is, you guessed it, another John Grisham adaptation. This one is directed by the one and only Francis Ford Coppola, released on November 21st, 1997. This is The Rainmaker.
The boy is dead.
You could be their next victim.
He'll come after you.
I hope he does.
In a world where justice is a game,
I want to expose these people.
Y'all are going to have your work cut out for you.
And power is an asset.
Do you even remember when you first sold out?
Better watch your back.
Courage is the only defense.
I advise you mind your manners. I'm in the big water now.
The Rainmaker, rated PG-13. Starts Friday, November 21st in theaters everywhere.
An underdog lawyer takes on a fraudulent insurance company. So, I feel like this is another example of a movie where it has a lot that it's juggling, and it's fine. I mean, it's after a point executed well, but I think at just some key level, it is struggling to put all of its pieces together. I don't know how you feel.
I think that this is a movie that is very clearly adapted from a novel, and I think that it probably works very well within the context of the novel, where you're juggling multiple cases that this lawyer is dealing with at one time, and all of these different plot threads and everything, and in the space of one feature-length film, it's too much. There's just like, there's way he's dealing with like three cases. And like when one case is over, he like picks up another case, and you're just like, whoa, what is going on? Is this a show? Is this a TV show? Because that's what that's what it feels like.
Yeah, that was the first impression I had. I watched this a couple of years ago, and that was the thing. Like, my only takeaway is it felt like the first three episodes of a TV show cut together and released as a movie.
It's good. The movie is good, but I just think that it's a little messy. It's a little bit messy.
And there are ways that the movie kind of could have used that to its advantage, but I don't think it really leans into them well enough to kind of maybe show it on how it's the effects of it on a more personal level, because it does kind of feel after a point very kind of above board and level in particular ways that the sort of intentional chaos of all this happening underneath it doesn't really correspond to.
No, and all the cases feel very, very segmented. They don't really go together other than the fact that you have, you know, the through line of Matt Damon being the lawyer. There's no like connecting tissue other than that as far as like theme or anything. You know, I guess you could say like, you know, he's like a lawyer with a heart. He really cares about his clients and stuff, but it's so bizarre how it sets it up with like three cases that he has, and one of them gets kind of thrown away fairly quickly. The one with the old lady where he moves in, that one's kind of thrown by the wayside very quickly. And then there's the case with Claire Danes, and that sort of turns into like the love story aspect of this, which feels a little odd. And then you have the big one where he's taking on this insurance company. He gets hired by this family who they believe that the insurance company falsely denied their claims and were doing something illegal, and as a result their son ended up passing away from leukemia, which was treatable. And you know, that aspect of it I thought was compelling. You had some really great courtroom moments in here. You had another really robust cast. Danny DeVito, who plays this like kind of ambulance chaser guy, he's great in it.
Yeah.
Mickey Rourke is also pretty good in this. He's like an even bigger sleazy lawyer type. I mean, is there any better person to play a sleazy lawyer than Mickey Rourke? I mean, come on.
He's so good in this too.
Yeah. And Mary Kay Place plays the mom, and she's really great in this. She's great in pretty much everything I've ever seen her in as well. And then you have John Voight as the opposing counsel. He's the defense attorney for this insurance company. And man, not only does he play a huge sleazebag, but some of the stuff that he says, like, I genuinely didn't understand what the hell he was talking about. There's a scene when he goes, I may not be 100%, but I'm here in spirit. And I'm like, what does that mean? I may not be 100%, but I'm here in spirit.
Be somewhere.
And then there's another one where he goes, he folded like a cheap suit. And I was like, what does that mean? Are cheap suits like thin and easy to fold? Or like, what does that mean? Like, a lot of his little sayings that he did, like, didn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. It doesn't feel like an intentional choice. Like, it's supposed to highlight the moral bankruptcy of the opposing counsel, because I think the movie does do a good job in the sense that this is the only case where it does go to trial, and we do see how the movie handles that, of showing how fragile this entire thing is going to be, how it's going to really depend on strength of the Matt Damon character and just the overall infrastructure that he has and the abilities that would be required to win this case, and the being able to put together the case and having the people who can really help him with that. Like, I think the main difference is, if, to kind of bookend what I was talking about at the start of the show, whereas the kind of Aaron Sorkin story courtroom is this very bright room where it's like, it's a room where we will see justice, if not served, then justice invoked. I think it's interesting that the courtroom in this movie is very dark. It's very dusty. There is no light. There is very unsettling, like, kind of faded sunlight coming into the windows. And I think that's kind of just to imply this room is whatever's happening in it. Like, it, there's nothing. It's, this is not like a hallowed special space of, like, you know, of where you could, like, practice whatever virtues of whatever kind of, like, civic spiritual connotations you want to give to the American courtroom. Like, it's whatever is going to happen in it on the strengths and weaknesses of not even, like, the arguments, but just, like, whatever is going to end up happening. Like, it's a really stresses that tentative quality.
Yeah, and I think that it looks quite good. Mm-hmm. For what it is, there is like a sort of dinginess to it. I like that. And just going back to like the length and everything that this movie encompasses. So you have Matt Damon here as this guy who is just out of law school. He hasn't even passed the bar exam yet. He's trying to get work. He's broke, and he gets a job with at Mickey Rourke's firm, and then eventually they like go off and they start their own firms. That's like a whole other thing where like Matt Damon and Danny DeVito like branch out and they go out on their own and they like lease a place and stuff. There's a funny line where they say that they have to lease computers. They have to lease a computer, and I'm like, wow, you had to lease a computer. Okay, that was a thing back then, apparently.
And it arguably feels like, if we're talking about this movie kind of feeling really fragmented, that maybe that could feel like it could be a fourth episode of the hypothetical The Rainmaker series that this all apparently seems to be edited together in.
Yeah, like they're shopping for a place, they're setting up their office, it's like this really, you know, it's a fixer-upper, they gotta fix it up, like perfect opportunity for a montage there. Either way, I mean, to me, this one felt the longest just because of how many different things were happening in it. Like, all the different, like, the Claire Danes stuff, the insurance company stuff, the, you know, Mickey Rourke committing, I don't know, what I can't remember even what he did, stole money or something.
Which is very telling because I think runtime-wise it's the shortest.
Yeah, and then there's, like, the lady with, like, her kids, and, like, her kids were trying to get money, and she was trying to put all of the money from her will into some televangelist, and there's so many, like, tendrils to this movie. And I think that, you know, it's still very entertaining. I still enjoyed it, but there was a lot going on, man. Just a lot going on.
It's a movie that is well made, but ultimately it just can't connect all of its pieces, perhaps because there's just too many of them that are just kind of scattered across it.
Yeah. Either way, I think performances solid across the board. You had Matt Damon. Was this the same year as Good Will Hunting? Yeah, it was. It was the same year as Good Will Hunting. So this was the start of the Damon dominance in the late 90s, early aughts. And everybody else was pretty solid too. Like, Claire Danes was great in it. She was quite good.
I think this is just like all these movies are examples of just like this just solid, as I said, mid-budget drama aimed at adults that just has a really good cast and just seeks to do what it has to do. And it's none of these movies, I think A Few Good Men is probably the best one out of them, but none of these movies were particularly incredible to me, but I just kind of admired them for all of their just straightforward directness and ability and resources they were allotted, which just feels so hard to imagine it happening now.
I agree. I think A Few Good Men is the strongest of the four. I think that, for me at least, The Firm would be a close second, and I think I had more fun with The Firm as far as, like, the journey.
Like a version of this movie. Like, I think The Firm is kind of the perfect example, because you do get these sort of, a major, like, studio movie with a big cast, like, aimed at adults that's just kind of competent and entertaining, like a movie that just is there to be part of, and I can't believe it, the summer release schedule.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, like, you know, the 90s, I mean, we went over, there were seven Grisham books adapted in the 90s, and that's just the Grisham stuff. You know, there were plenty of other courtroom dramas, legal thrillers that came out throughout the decade, and I feel like you had a lot more of them during that time. I feel like you don't see as many of them, you know, nowadays. Like, you have maybe one or two that come out every other year or so. And to me, you know, like, looking at, again, at the Trial of the Chicago 7, just as, like, the most recent example I can think of, like, it feels different. It's, like, not, it just is just not the same. It's, like, that movie is just so much more glossy and sensationalized, where these movies, there's just a lot of people shuffling papers around and looking at documents and stuff, like we talked about before. And I don't know. I feel like we don't get, every now and then, you know, we'll get one, but I feel like for the most part, we just don't see a whole lot of these legal thrillers compared to what we used to see.
I think that's why there hasn't been a Grisham adaptation in so long. I think it just got to a point where the
saturation level was
the flow of the way that Hollywood makes these movies, they just didn't know what to do with his work anymore.
I think a lot of this stuff went to TV too. Like, we started seeing a lot more courtroom dramas on TV, and even Grisham stuff started getting adapted to TV, so maybe that's part of it. Interestingly, they adapted The Client into a TV series. Not sure how that works, but they did The Firm too.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think there was a Firm adaptation as well.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I don't know.
Apparently, it's a sequel.
What?
It's set 10 years after The Firm.
How does that work? The Firm.
Well,
the firm. All right. Well,
the 2012 television. This is from Wikipedia. The 2012 television show picks up on the story of Mitchell Y. McDear and his family 10 years after the fictional setting of the 1991 novel and 1993 film. In the original film and book, McDear helped when the Chicago mob boss dies in prison, the McDears emerge from witness protection to start their new life. The television adaptation remains...
It sounds like it's not even... I mean, it's like not even based on an actual Grisham story. It's just continuing the events of the first one. And also, like, I don't know, why would he have to go into witness protection? He was working with the mob. Like, he didn't do anything. Like, the mob knew about him. Like, he didn't do anything to... He gave up the firm, not the mob. So
it feels like one of those shows where the credit is probably, like, based on characters created by John Grisham.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Well, it looks like he was an executive producer, so... I mean, that could mean...
That can mean anything. Yeah, I think executive producer sometimes means slightly more on television than it does on movies. Or I don't know. Executive producer could mean anything. I mean, 11 television shows a week on NBC probably say executive producer Dick Wolf at the end.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's enough. I don't know how much that man likes to work. I assume he likes enjoys his job, but I don't think he has time to be executive producing with, you know, capital E, capital P, all of that.
Yeah, he sits back and collects checks at this point.
I think there's like going to be like an entire night of NBC programming this fall that's apparently just Law and Order shows.
Really?
It looked like it was done. It looked like it was going to be like SVU and that was out, but now they brought back, they're doing one with like, they brought back Chris Maloney's character and they're doing another one that I don't know anything about, but it's so weird.
Because the Chris Maloney one, is that just on Peacock or is that on NBC as well?
I think it's on actual NBC.
Oh, I thought that was just on Peacock. I watched the first episode of it, but I just couldn't really get into it.
Yeah, like that's the thing is, I feel like it's a show that has more like prominence than people say this all the time, but like the Law and Order shows, you know, we'll talk about the effect they have in the society, but like. It's more than I could believe there are three Law and Order shows on. I never believe the number of NCIS shows that are on CBS at any given time. Yeah. Like how I never believe that it's like one of the most popular shows in the country, because when's the last time someone went to you and talked about NCIS?
Yeah, that's that. I remember there were a ton of those. The CSIs, there's like CSI Los Angeles.
There's gonna be more CSI sometime soon.
Do you remember the one Law and Order that was like real life? It was like the real life Law and Order that they did.
It was like a reality show. I remember hearing about that. Did that ever happen?
Yeah, it happened. It was. I was probably on. I think it was on for like one season.
Mm-hmm.
I know there was one. I think there was one where it was just like the law part. It was like just the law part of Law and Order.
Yeah. Law and Order. Trial by Jury, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the one. It was the one with Lilith from Frasier and Cheers.
Yeah, there's Law and Order Trial by Jury, which was not that only did 13 episodes. There was Law and Order Criminal Intent, which had Vincent D'Onofrio on it and was on for I think like 10 years, and it went to the USA Network.
Yeah, that was on. Yeah, I remember that was on for forever. That's still on. I mean, they still play it on USA. Like,
yeah,
most of the day is Law and Order on USA.
Oh yeah. And then there was, and I remember hearing about this, and I think I remember hearing about this. They did for ITV where they adapted old episodes of the original Law and Order and adapted it to try and fit the mold of the British legal system, and it was just Law and Order UK.
Yeah, I didn't see any of those. I remember there was a cybercrime one too, wasn't there? It was like Law and Order.
That was CSI. There was CSI cybercrime. I saw a couple episodes of that. It was
it's Patricia Arquette, wasn't it?
Yeah, Patricia Arquette. It was weird.
I remember watching a few of them because I was like, obviously I was interested just because I like computer stuff and all of that and technology. And I watched like two episodes. I'm like, nope, I can't do this. It was like, it was ridiculous.
It's the CBS primetime level of understanding of computers.
Yeah, it was just. It was sci-fi. I mean, they were getting into just straight up sci-fi territory with it. I think that'll wrap it up for this month. Thank you so much for listening. You can send us your questions and 90s picks to 90s@filmpulse.com or by sending us a DM on Twitter or Facebook at 90spod. If you have a moment, please consider reviewing us on iTunes. That would be super helpful. Until next month. For Ken Bakley, my name is Adam Patterson, and this has been Saved by the 90s.
Bye, everyone.